Hello, Brad here. Just to say we're super proud that the Friday 5pm podcast is sponsored by the Malt Miller, the UK's best home brew store.
We use the Malt Miller for all of our homebrew experiments, as well as tapping them up for advice and binging on their awesome YouTube channel all the time.
That's why whenever we release a homebrew video, we put a recipe kit live on the Malt Miller, so you can brew with the exact same amazing ingredients that we did. The same ingredients used by pro brewers.
So alongside the Malt Miller's nitro-flushed hops, cold-stored yeast and milled-to-order malts, you can pick up recipe kits for our 5 Points Best Bitter, Russian River West Coast IPA, and now the fastest beer in the world, a hazy session IPA that goes from grain to glass in less than 48 hours.
Sign up to their newsletter at tinyurl.com/Malt Miller to get 5% off your first order. With the Malt Miller's amazing customer service and Johnny's 48-hour recipe, you could order the ingredients on a Monday and be drinking the beer by the weekend.
Speaking of which, it's Friday.
It's 5pm.
So enjoy this week's Friday 5pm podcast. Hey, Beer Geeks, and welcome to a very special episode of The Bubble. Special because we have not one, but two very special guests. Most important of whom is, of course, Bradley.
It is I. I have taken my throne on The Bubble. The bubbly, soft throne of The Bubble. I'm going to get Bubble in there a few more times. Bubble.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah, you're nailed on to the concept. So Brad on his Bubble throne is joining us for what is essentially kind of the full stop on our campaign that's been running for the last month or so, which is Keep Cask Alive, our championing and singing the praises of Cask Ale, sponsored by the lovely people at Fuller's. So we've spent the last month editing and releasing, but the last sort of 6 months filming a series of documentaries all about the joy of British cask ale and why we think it needs, deserves, and must get better protection. And all that culminated after trips to Hook Norton, to one of our favourite pubs and where the Craft Beer Channel started, the Old Fountain, plus Abbeydale, Dark Star, Fuller's itself, and the micro pubs of Thanet. All that culminated in us deciding to start a new campaign under the same name to try and get cask ale listed by UNESCO as an example of intangible heritage, which we hope will mean that the government takes the plight of cask ale seriously, because it is still in double-digit decline. Pubs are still closing. And interest in it hasn't been piqued by the craft beer industry as much as we kind of hoped. So that's basically going to be the big project for next year. And we wanted to get some thoughts and some advice from a sage, somebody of the alcohol industry, but not maybe beer, and get some tips. And obviously to meet him, because he's one of my absolute heroes.
He's an absolute ledge, let's be honest.
Are we going to reveal who it is? Or?
I've just said he's a man. His enthusiasm is palpable. He jumps out of the screen on Saturday Kitchen and numerous other sort of TV ventures. Who is he, Johnny?
He's Ollie Smith.
Oh, come on.
And it's just occurred to me that his name's in the name of the podcast. But, yeah, we've got a really fun hour coming with the amazing wine writer, wine communicator, and author. He has a new book coming out, which I'll let him plug, because he stole the moment where I was going to plug my book. But it's all about making cocktails at home, and it looks beautiful. So yeah, we talked to him. He is a huge cask ale lover. He pretty much lives in Sussex because Harvey's is there. And we talked to him about the burdens of being a drinks writer. We talked to him about his love of cask, his favourite pubs, what he thinks can be done to improve the reputation and just the quality of cask ale. I was really surprised and impressed by the knowledge and the passion that he has for all drinks, not just wine, but in particular beer. I mean, he's clearly a man who really, really loves cask. And we need more people like that shouting and singing the praises of it.
Yeah, man, I think Ollie is just a force of nature when it comes to liquid libations. He was even enjoying his oolong tea to a different level than I've seen a man enjoy an oolong tea. So I think we should get into it. It's going to be awesome.
So this is the amazing Ollie Smith talking to us about Keep Cask Alive.
I love that stuff. Been drinking it for years. Drinking it for years. Drinking it for years. Drinking it for years. You know, I really recently decided to add more hops to it. To it. Hops to it. You know, I really recently decided to add more hops to it. To it. Hops to
Ollie, thank you so much for joining us on The Bubble. I have to say it's an absolute honour to get to talk to you, having watched you on Saturday Kitchen for so long.
Yeah, you're absolute legends. That's so nice of you to say. I likewise, I've really enjoyed the videos you've done in support of Cask. I thought they were brilliant. Whoever produced them, edited them and starred them deserves an Oscar. So I'm thrilled to be here. I love all things drink, but I am a massive fan of Cask. So I'm delighted to join you.
Yeah, well, we'll dig into the world of Cask in a bit, but it would be great since we have you to have a chat about firstly how you got into alcohol. That makes it sound like a problem rather than a career. How you got into wine, I guess, because I was doing some research, as professionals do before podcasts, and it seems you were a screenwriter beforehand.
It's true. I used to write scripts for Pingu and Charlie and Lola and Wallace and Gromit. A long time ago, I specialised in animation, and I kind of got into it in a very long way. I wrote a show that the BBC kind of were half interested in, but then my spec scripts got seen by a lot of producers, and suddenly I found myself writing for some fairly big names in the kids' animation industry. I think Pingu, though, my heart goes out to Pingu, because, yes, of course, technically they're not speaking English, but those scripts were like writing silent comedies. It was like writing for Lauren and Hardy. So you had to move all the maquettes around, make sure they were doing fun things, you know, have some sort of an engaging structure to the show and make sure that people of all ages, I mean, it was a preschool show, but make sure that people of all ages could enjoy it. And there's a lot of students out there that still come up to me to this day who are enormous fans of Pingu. I can't say what they were enjoying while they were watching Pingu, but it certainly seemed to hit the spot.
Help pass the time. I'd love to see those scripts. Was it so you do like what's happening on screen and then they just be like nope?
Exactly. So you describe what's happening on scene and you basically say, Pingu comes, it's all demonstrative. So like Pingu's dad would be like, don't touch the oven. Pingu's grandfather would be like, don't put your flipper in the paint pot. And then Pingu would, of course, you know, do both things. Chaos ensues with comic effect. But you would literally meticulously write every pratfall and gag and also every tender moment. So it was always trying to find a way into whose story it was and why. And you'd be amazed at the amount of time and detail we went into. So, you know, for example, if it's, you know, Pingu's story, but maybe Pingu's ill and he's got to nurse her and they've run out of milk or whatever it is, he has to go out and get it. So he's on a mission, but it's a mission with a purpose. And I've actually got scripts I can show you. I'll put them on the website if you like. I can put, you know, Pingu gets lost. That was one... so heartfelt. Poor little chap. I think I made his dad knit him a jersey so that he would go out into the wild. He didn't like the jersey, but then it sort of snagged on a bit of ice and he went into an ice cave maze and of course found his way out by retracing his steps with the wool that had come off his jumper. But I really loved it, and I think all of the kind of communication skills that I kind of basically learned from having zero words to deal with probably really helped me in my career, which followed as, you know, being a person who enthuses about drinks, you know, on wherever I can. I just think if you can convey anything, you know, enthusiasm and I think, you know, if you can be a bit eloquent as well, then hurrah. But basically get people excited about the thing you're talking about. That's for me the name of the game. And always remember, you know, it's the thing you're talking about that's the important thing rather than yourself. And I think if you get out of the way of the topic and let the topic do the talking, you're on fire, basically. It's brilliant.
So speaking as fellow communicators, I think one of the biggest battles we often have is trying to express very complicated processes and ideas as briefly as possible. And on YouTube, you know, people's attention spans on YouTube are not famously long. Perhaps they're enjoying what they enjoy during Pingu. And I guess on Saturday Kitchen and in a lot of the work you do, it's also about brevity but complexity at the same time.
It's an act, isn't it? And I think you do a great job on the channel, because it's not an easy thing to convey a lot of information and knowledge into something that is going to just inspire somebody to take that step and try the thing you're talking about. I think that's really the most important thing for me, is that you give the confidence to the person you're speaking to think, oh, I really want to be part of that. You know, when I started in wine, I worked in a wine shop, actually, and I was delivering boxes. But I remember it was a time when wine was very much for a certain type of person. And that person really wasn't me at the time. You know, hadn't really broken into the supermarkets. I didn't know anything about it. I was probably 17, 18 when I started being a storeman on a Saturday, just lugging the boxes around and taking them to their destinations. But I quickly realized that, you know, it's really about the person you're talking to. You know, it's all about them. You know, if they're interested enough to ask you a question, then really it's on behalf of them that you should be picking something out and saying, this is absolutely up your street, within your budget. It's going to pair beautifully with what you're cooking tonight. And you're going to feel great because it's something you've never had before. And I think if you can really just connect with people in that way, then everybody just has, you know, more beneficial and more exciting experiences. And then it's infectious. People just then want to tell other people how great, you know, the topic is or whatever. And that's, yeah, that's just too exciting. But it does all ultimately track back to the great producers, you know, the people who create these amazing liquids that, you know, we all three of us and everybody listening, I'm sure, is so fond of.
This summer, I'm going to be hosting talks at the Manchester, Bristol and London Craft Beer Festivals, giving festival goers the chance to attend tutored tastings, rare beer pours, meet the brewers and even guided tours of the bars. These three festivals are the highlights of my events calendar, featuring some of the world's best breweries with delicious restaurant pop-ups, great music and a really welcoming party atmosphere. It's the third year I've been hosting the We Are Beer Tastings table, but for the first time, I'm delighted to offer all of our listeners, viewers and Patreons £5 off a ticket when you use the code CBC5. Just hit the link in the description to buy. See you there. So how did you end up falling for wine?
Well, this is a very good question. It really was through my relationship with the store, the other storeman, Eamon, who worked with me in the basement, who was a retired publican. And he spoke about wine in the way that you might speak about in those days about a pint. You know, succinct, enthusiastic, you know, the right information, just enough to make you think, oh, yeah, I'll give that a try. And I love that attitude. You know, he was just super informal. And the guys on the shop floor above did a really good job. But I thought there's something about the way Eamon talks about wine. I think from being a landlord, just from being able to chat with people and be super down to earth. And it's a great, I think it's vocational. It's not just a skill. A great landlady or a great landlord is just, it's the dream. So all of those communication skills kind of fell into me. And I thought, yeah, you know what? I really like this. And it felt like a territory that hadn't really been explored for my generation, you know, turning 18 and going into early 20s. None of my friends were at all interested in wine. It was all, at the time, it was kind of, you know, it was beers like Grolsch and the usual kind of candidates that were out there where we were. But I was, again, I was a little bit quirky in that regard, because when I turned 18, my paradise night with my buddy was to go to the old house at home in Chidham and try all the cask ales, if we could, on the bar. And I remember the names just jumping out at me. They're still in my mind. You know, Orkney Raven from that night is still looms large. So I think I got into the world of wine, beer and kind of all of it really at the same time. But wine was the thing that I felt I could be an advocate for. I felt that I could bring people into the fold that would just never have thought that wine was for them. So my motto very quickly became all for wine and wine for all, because that's, yeah, it's the way I feel about it. And kind of the way I feel about life, to be honest. I think the more the merrier, everybody's welcome.
I think,
Ollie,
go on, Brad.
Ollie, do you think the attraction to wine and to great beer is the fact that you're a storyteller, and there are more stories in these rather than, you know, your Carlsbergs and all that kind of stuff, which didn't interest you. Were you always seeking out the stories in the glass?
I think that's right. And I think it was the stories. You're bang on. I also think it was the traveling. So that to have a lineup of casks, you know, that were from different corners of the country, that, you know, whenever I go anywhere, I want to just dive into what everybody else is tasting and doing. So if I'm off to Seville, I want to try the tapas, I want to drink the sherry, I want to learn how to dance the Sevillana, you know. And it's just something I've always felt is like you get the best out of anywhere. Same in Britain, you know, wherever I go anywhere, whether it's Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland, you know, Cornwall, I am there to try what the locals have created. So it's tracking back through that story to the people and then the heritage, you know. In your videos online, I just loved, you know, the kind of the Hook Norton, you know, the long term investment in communities. And these are values that are coming back, which I think is terrific. And where I live in East Sussex. And part of the reason I moved here, my wife's from Brighton, and we had our kids here, and we moved here probably 20, 25 years ago. But we moved to Lewis originally. And the first night we moved to Lewis, I will never forget it, you know, tasting a pint of Harvey's Best and thinking, I have just moved to the greatest place on earth. And now, of course, I've got the Beak Brewery in Lewis. I've got Burning Sky over in Firle. You know, I've got amazing wine growers all around me. And when I moved here, that really wasn't the case. You know, it was like a couple of vineyards. What's happening in the drinks culture here, right here in East Sussex, where I live, is something I really want to share with the world. And that's exactly what I was doing in reverse all those years ago, looking at the lineup on the bar and thinking, I want to travel to every corner of Great Britain and taste through history what everybody has enjoyed, because they've endured. So there's got to be something good about them, right? And this is why your campaign is so important, because we want them to last into the future and to get a whole new generation feeling the way we do, particularly about cask, but about the respect for it and the kind of love for it and the veneration, and therefore the joy you get when you share it with your mates.
It was an interesting thing you said just a couple of minutes ago about how the idea of sort of travel and going to specific places to try things that have originated there is coming back, because I think particularly in beer, that's something that completely disappeared for a good couple of decades. And, you know, the craft beer revolution, whatever you want to call it, has done many great things. But what it did do that probably wasn't great was to create this kind of fetishization of foreign beer. So of American hops and American style brewing, and cask. You know, I thought that cask would be really helped by the craft beer revolution, and actually it feels like it's been slightly left behind.
Yeah, it's a good point. I filmed two shows out in America called Ollie Smith's Ale Trails for the Discovery Channel many years ago when craft was just kind of hitting. And I was absolutely enthralled by the hops, you know, delighted by the big flavors. It was just at the sort of beginning of the sort of hop, you know, Armageddon War, you know, who can make the obvious pint. And I was over on the West Coast. I was in Portland. I was down in, you know, all over the place. Where did I go? Everywhere. Denver, Miami. I mean, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. But I kept saying to people, oh, you know, where I come, you know, in my home, you know, there's this thing called cask. And, you know, the one thing I missed from the beers, you know, I loved the exuberance and I loved the styles and I loved the experimentation, but I just, you know, all I was looking for in any of them was balance. And I would always come back to, you know, a really good pint of cask beer, you know, a best bitter made by one of our great breweries. And so that for me is one of the most balanced drinks in the world. You've got extraordinary texture and mouthfeel, really like elegant and beautiful, you know, delicate, tiny bubbles that, no, you know, no, to my knowledge, no wine could deliver. You've also got depth of flavor. You've got character. You've got food pairings. You've got lasting profiles. You've got, you know, any style you'd care to mention within the format to entrance any palate. And I was just, they were looking blankly at me. The one place when I did series two was Portland, when I went into one of the brew pubs there and they were like, oh yeah, we've really heard of it, we're actually going to travel to the UK to try some. And this was back in the day. And then years later I did a show with Dom Jolly for Warner Brothers called How Beer Changed the World, and we kind of went around the world, and in that series I remember there was a far deeper conversation about the reverence for cask. And we obviously looked at German beers, Belgian beers, went to China, we went all around the world. So it was a total thrill to do. But the beer I kept coming back to really in my head was always just this balanced, beautiful, quite sort of, you know, it's a calming beer. It's a convivial thing. It's a delight, and it is a portal for me into just a long stretch of great conversation and the best day you're ever going to have.
So why do you think you can't see this, but Ollie's just hands in the air.
I'm like, what else is there? It's like, I mean, don't get me wrong. I still do drink, you know, I love craft and I've mentioned the beak and I love all that, but you know, it is, there's something about, and the condition of it and the care. And anyway, sorry. Yes, I get excited.
we've seen lots of breweries in the States as well. There's a growing reverence for British beer culture, I think. And Brad and I, in our travels around the States, have come across plenty of breweries that now produce cask ale.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
There's a wonderful one in Philadelphia called Forest and Main. And we went there, they were serving saisons on cask, like putting terrific. All kinds of stuff on the format, because we're like, we just think that level of carbonation, that freshness is brilliant for these styles. But do you have any thoughts as to why, sort of to some extent, the British have been quite blind to the joy of it and why it's in decline?
I think it's always that thing that whatever's close to home, you sort of take for granted is the truth. You know, I visited the Channel Islands recently and I hadn't been there for like 20 years. I've got some friends who've lived there, and, you know, I was just every turn around the corner, I was totally speechless at the beauty of the cliffs, the amazing ocean, you know, the sheer scale of the skyscape. And they were like, yeah, it's really nice. And I think it's not that they don't love it. Of course they love it. But it's like anything. If it's right on your doorstep, and if it's something that, you know, maybe dad or granddad did, then, you know, I think there's partly that. I also do think, you know, the hit and miss condition that it's served in. I've had that. You've had that. It's a problem. And, you know, when you are served an amazing, balanced, beautiful pint, you know, that has just reverence for that process, then it is completely different if you're served something that's just a bit stale. And those, I think, are the real reasons. And I do also think pricing, you know, it's so hard, you know, I wish there was more of a favorable kind of attitude towards Cask, because I do think it's like a heritage issue in the way that we would protect, you know, a dialect or a language. I do look on these things, you know, whether it's a DO for a cheese or a particular style of, you know, curing a meat or a vegetable. You know, there's an appellation for cauliflower within Rioja in Spain. It's not just the wine there. You know, people get serious about this stuff. And I almost think it's almost framing beer in the same way. Like, I'll give you an example. Whenever I'm in Lewis, I love the Harvey's Brewery, big fan of what they do. But I always kind of wonder why there aren't just lines of tourists outside taking selfies as there would be if it was Chateau Margaux, because I think of it in exactly the same way. And actually, I kind of think what they're delivering, you know, and what traditional brewers can deliver you in that pint is just something that's world class. And it's extraordinary to me that we have access to it readily in the pubs that we do, in the good pubs that we do. So I think it's a combination of factors. And I think a lot of people would also incorrectly assume it was just one style of beer, which I think is a big part of the messaging we need to convey, is like the word you use, which actually I think is the most fantastic word to describe it, is freshness. It's all about that unpasteurized, you know, you'd call it, you know, à point if you're having an amazing dish, you know, served totally correctly at the right moment. So it's you meeting the beer. So yeah, there's a lot in there, but basically we need to really just pull some more pints and get people to taste it. So I think we should, you know, launch an enormous beer festival with Fullers. I'll put on a silly costume and march in on stilts, and we'll just get, you know, whoever wants to come can come. There, simple, easy, done.
I like the idea of you on stilts at a beer festival. I can't see what could go wrong with that.
You don't have much stilt practice? Are you I won't lie, Brad.
I don't think I do, but I'd learn if it was in the cause of the Cask. I mean, you know, there's no length I wouldn't go to. You know, there's a lot of my mates who over the years just would drink a pint of lager, and I'm thinking specifically actually of my mate Nick, who it took me a little, you know, a few years, but once I got him into the idea of it, you know, he travels to pubs and to regions to taste, you know, these revered, hallowed drinks. And I couldn't be more thrilled for him. He gets a great hobby. He likes hill walking. He likes nature. And at the end of it, he's rewarded with a really tasty brew.
Amen.
That is the dream. So I'm interested, so in the idea that maybe beer communicators and brewers and the industry of a whole have got the messaging a little bit wrong around Cask and around beer. Because like you say, there are some wineries that people will almost do pilgrimages to, and there are some breweries that people will pilgrimage to, but typically they're not traditional British cask ale producers. Like, have you looked at beer communication or brewery communication and gone, that's not the right way to do it, or here's a better way?
That's a good question, actually. I think there are some amazing beer communicators out there from a younger generation. I do think, though, largely, you know, the pilgrimages that are being made are towards, you know, modern brew pubs and more towards the craft side of things. And I can totally see why. They've got the kind of vibe, you know, the cool branding, and it feels like something entirely fresh and modern, you know, but every, you know, shooting star has an arc. And I kind of think there's just a much longer arc for me to the story of Cask. And I sort of think, yeah, we've kind of, it's hidden behind a cloud a bit at the moment, but I think its best days are ahead. I really do, because when people realize, you know, think of all the things people really love now, you know, whether it's cooking, you know, it might be something as simple as sourdough, but the way people's tastes have expanded. And I think the care for buying local and, you know, investing in your community and your people and the values of those people, I think that's where Cask actually can have a really, really like positive story to tell, because they have lasted through world wars and extraordinary amounts of time. And it does connect us to our sense of place quite uniquely. And yeah, I think if we can inject a sense of, I was going to use the word pizzazz, and then I realized it's something that Alan Partridge would say. So I'm withdrawing from pizzazz, and I'll go with, you know, let's go for something a bit more electric. You know, we need to electrify the, you know, and make people feel like it's more of you know, a festival, a fiesta. You know, there's wonderful, you know, when you go to a great food festival and you feel like you're just part of something so spectacular and alive. That's the feeling we need to get. It's like catching that first wave. If you've ever been in the water and done a little bit of body surfing or whatever, that sense of invigoration, like, I can't wait for the next one. That's the feeling we want to bring to it. And if I can help in any regard, I will. But I do think there are good communicators. I think maybe we need to reinvigorate the festival format around it a bit and the experiential side. that's, you know, that's all to play for. That can be done relatively simply. You know, bring in some bands, bring in some stand-up, you know, we're there.
And Ollie on stilts.
Yeah, I'm in. I'm totally in.
It's interesting what you say, because we, obviously, Brad and I, we've run the channel for 8 years. We've travelled all over the world making films about it. And genuinely, one of the most surprising visits we've ever done was that Hook Norton Brewery. Like, we'd selected it because we'd done the research. Like, I knew it was beautiful. I grew up in Oxfordshire, so I've been drinking Hookie and Old Hookie for, you know, since I was 18.
Yeah,
but still,
ah, oh, Brett's holding up a Hookie Gold.
Are you having that legend, with breakfast, Brad?
it's 11 a.m. but I wasn't sure if we were going to be drinking, so I got this out
just in case. And
a little dimple mug. I salute you, Ollie.
I love a dimple mug as well. I do. Yeah, so you chose it and you did a great job, because it showed, you know, how those traditions have been kept. And, you know, okay, they're not doing it in the same, you know, oak, they've plastic lined it and stuff, but it delivers the same beer. And I remember similarly, I went up to Massam and Malham and all around there, and I remember seeing, you know, Black Sheep, and just, you know, the work that is done to bring these things to life. It's not easy. And actually in Hookie, those guys with the valves, you know, just, you know, it's so by hand. It couldn't be, I'm going to use the word craft, it couldn't be more of a craft. It's like they're working every single dial. I just thought, wow, it's just like something out of Jules Verne.
Yeah, and I absolutely loved the little bit where they were talking, George was talking about how there is a manual, but if you followed the manual, you fuck it up. Like, you don't know how far to turn this dial from a manual. And to me, that is, you know, as far as the actual production process, that's as craft as it gets, as in literally only a few people know how far to turn that wheel.
Yeah, and it's nuance, isn't it? And it's feeling, it's like, you know, I love my dog Busby, and I know I'm probably better than anyone, but, you know, there's no manual for Busby. It's just like, you've got to just hang out with them and get to know them. And then you're like, ah, you like a beer bone at this time of the day, and you like your walk then, and, you know, you quite like a cuddle and scratch. And he actually really likes watching Deadliest Catch, which I've never fathomed, but it's his favorite show. I think he just looks at the crabs and thinks they're just like weird dogs and gets excited. But no, I think that Hookie, that sense of, you know, doing the job, lifting things and getting involved, you know, that, you know, and seeing the hops, you know, as they're just sitting there, you know, chipping them off to use them, and British hops as well, which is lovely to see, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think if there is a season two, Fullers, what we'd love to do is to show the production side of the hops and the malts as well, which we've shown on the channel before, but never in the context really of proper traditional British brewing, and seeing, you know, farm to, you know, going to the farms of down in Kent, and then taking that up to Hookie would be such a wonderful, like you say, that shooting star arc.
Yeah, I remember I was out in a maltings, I think it might have been Denver, I can't remember, but there was a sort of specialised maltings that had moved into the area of just talking to brewers about what they actually wanted, you know, in the way that hop growers used to. And this was a long time ago, but I was really struck by that until then there hadn't really been that two-way conversation. And that, you know, you're right, that story of, you know, grain into bottle and, you know, the process it goes through, I'd love to see that, you know, and all across Britain. Oh yeah, series two, definitely, please, I'd watch it.
I've just written a book, Ollie.
Have you? I have.
I don't know. I can show you it, one second.
While you're showing me your book, I'm going to relentlessly, ruthlessly show Bradley mine. This is the Home Cocktail Bible. Home Cocktail Bible. Yeah, it's available for pre-order from Amazon. And it is basically more than 200 recipes that will be... And it's a lovely Christmas gift as well. All really simple. So it's done by spirit. You've got gin, you've got vodka, anything you want. It's all in your drinks cabinet. And
the photography looks beautiful, Ollie. Who did the photography?
It was Matt Russell, who has the best playlist.
In
the... You don't know Matt Russell.
I know Matt Russell.
How do you guys know Matt Russell?
He does some work with Jamie Oliver, photography-wise.
Yeah. That's him. Yeah, Ledge. He's nice a complete guy. Ledge. Best playlist in the business, though. Got me through those days of just, building drinks. And then he's a wizard, isn't he, Matt? Hope he's listening. He's should send this to him on a private link, and then he'll definitely listen. And for everyone else who's wondering who Matt Russell is, he's a brilliant photographer who has amazing taste in music. And he did do the shots for the Home Cocktail Bible. I had to get it in again. I had to. Okay, so what's your book?
Well, my book is called A Year in Beer. It's all about seasonality and brewing.
Love that. Seasonality and brewing, of course.
Which there's only been one book done beforehand and on that topic, and it wasn't great. So I sort of picked up the mantle because I wanted to tell those stories about the production process from going before the actual brewing and going into the hops and the malts, and also the context of it, the climate, that all makes a huge difference, and that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, we often look at craft as the ultimate form of brewing as very complicated, using incredible ingredients, but, you know, that has been going on for centuries in the UK, and we've kind of forgotten that. I love what you said about the shooting star of it. There's so much of an arc that's come before you actually see that star sort of going by.
Totally true. And you know, physical things that go into making it that have been guarded for decades, like yeast. I mean, yeast is a very, very important component. And I'm quite, you know, as a hobby, I'm quite into fungi in general. I find them really the third force, as it's called. It's not an animal, it's not a kind of plant. But it is this force that is around us that we depend on for fermentation, for, you know, baking bread. You know, there's so many uses for it. And, you know, we're recording this in mushroom season at the moment, so I've been out and about having a look at what pops up. And it is just staggering, the diversity of these, yeah, this third force. But I don't think certainly in wine, really, you know, I don't think we talk about the role of yeast enough and the impact it has on flavors. We sort of talk about wild yeast and natural fermentations a bit. But yeah, that too, you know, is such a direct link to the place and therefore to, yeah, the seasonality. I'm definitely buying your book, by the way. Is it available for pre-order on Amazon?
It's on the big guys, yeah, but also directly from Camera, the publisher.
Oh, I will totally do. Oh, I've got another camera book here, actually. Sorry, I'm just going to knock my mic.
Sorry, no plugs for any other beer people.
Okay, we'll cut this out. But this is just, have you come across Gabe?
Oh, Gabe. Yeah. He's our next guest on the podcast, strangely.
No way. Well, look, let's give Gabe a mention. I've just been out in the orchards with Gabe Cook, and his Modern British Cider book by Camera as well is very, very good. But we're here to plug your book, not Gabe's book. Now, he will be
we're here to plug your book, Ollie.
Oh, well, that's very nice. The Home Cocktail Bible. I don't think they've heard of it. Gabe, hang on, I'm just going to move my mic. Gabe will be a phenomenal, phenomenal guest. He's a legend.
Over the last few years, we've become obsessed with homebrewing at the Craft Beer Channel.
We have. I used to think it was only the professionals who could make great beer, but we've come to realise that it's not only achievable at home, but also much easier and more fun than I thought.
Yeah, people think homebrewing is hard to get into, but it's really not. You can start super basic, and there are some great resources and stores out there.
Absolutely, and that's why we're delighted that this podcast is sponsored by The Malt Miller.
Yeah, they've made getting into brewing so much easier for people at home. Even we've managed to make some amazing beer.
We have. Remember that time we impressed Verdon's head brewer with our hazy IPA and Jamie Oliver with our red IPA and brewed our own cask bitter?
Hell yeah, man. I wish we could make those beers again.
Well, we can, mate, because all our best homebrew recipes are available on The Malt Miller, along with loads of other great recipe kits.
And you can still make your own recipes, right?
Absolutely. We work with The Malt Miller because they have an incredible range of over 100 hot products, 150 malts, and 350 different yeasts. The exact same quality as what the professionals use, and they're all carefully stored and shipped on an overnight service for freshness.
So with all that, the only limit is how deep down the rabbit hole you want to go.
Exactly. You could just stick to making extract brews of your favourite beers, or build a full brewery in the backyard.
Who'd do a mad thing like that, Johnny?
No idea, but I bet they get all their stuff from themaltmiller.co.uk. That vaguely leads on to my next question, which is about English wine.
Yes.
So obviously, you know, cask has been around for a long time, and Britain has been famous, probably famous outside of the UK more than it is in the UK for its sensational brewing. But are there any parallels to English wine? You know, what's been the process of trying to promote it? Has it always been bad, or has it been always quite good and we're only just starting to
That's an excellent question. I think it hasn't been great. It was great, presumably, in Roman times when they brought it over because they all loved it. And then it was just very quiet. You know, the monasteries, you know, had a few vineyards, and then nothing much happened till the 50s. There was a couple of revival attempts down in Hampshire. 80s, you know, I was tasting some stuff that was interesting rather than amazing. And then suddenly, boom, the 90s hit. And I was tasting things that were blowing my mind. And I started collecting English wine quite seriously towards the late 90s. I really bought in early and thought, this is absolutely going to be an amazing, amazing revolution. Because I was seeing wine growers traveling the world, coming back with the know-how and realizing that marginal climates around the world can successfully deliver the goods. You know, think of Otago in New Zealand. It's pretty cold down there. You know, the further south you get, it's pretty chilly. We're on the edge of it. But that's where the action is. You know, that's where you get thrilling levels of acidity. So in the sparkling wines, we're on average 1 degree cooler than the Champagne region. We're getting these really tense, nervy, Blanc de Blanc, which is only made from Chardonnay traditionally, wines. But when you taste them young, and by young, I would say anything under 10 years, to be perfectly honest, you know, they are exhilarating and amazing. If you're lucky enough to have some fresh shellfish, fantastic. But I've been keeping these back, and they just reveal so much in the second decade. And I know having the patience and the luxury of having a place to keep them is not everybody will have it, but you can buy them when they've got a bit of bottle age, and they are a bit more expensive. Wow, is the quality there though? So I think we're only scratching the surface, and I've mentioned Fizz. I'm really excited. I've seen some good rosé. I've seen some good red. Flint in Norfolk are making some very good Pinot Noir Précoce, but I'm seeing some very good white wine, some really astonishing Bacchus. Hoffman and Rathbone make some truly incredible stuff using oak, acacia wood, fermenting in concrete eggs and all sorts of wonderful wizardry that they use. But the bottom line is you spend 20 quid on that bottle of wine, which is a big spend, but you are going to have a great time drinking it. And all your friends will agree. It's one of those unanimous, stick it down on the table. Everybody goes, what is that? And if you want a glimpse into that style, Newhall Bacchus from Essex, it's around a tenner from their website. It's a really good iteration of Bacchus. It smells like elderflowers, tastes like a pink grapefruit meteorite. It's an absolute dazzler. I've listed it in my glasshouse wine bars actually on P&O Cruises because I think it's that good. I absolutely love it. So we barely know what we can do yet. And I think for me, it's too early to start carving out corners of the country and saying, this is our appellation for this. This is what we do here. This is what we do there. It took the monks in Burgundy, you know, a long time, centuries to discover what really worked, to finesse that. And yeah, we're on the journey, but let's not rush it. You know, let's see what we can do. And we can't really talk about old vines yet. We've got pockets of them, but nothing really meaningful. And old vines maybe create less fruit, but what they do produce is really characterful. So that provides a whole really interesting spectrum. But I couldn't be more excited about it. And I kind of think the worlds of wine, beer and cider and all of our spirits produced locally, you know, I really want us all to unite. You know, I would love to be involved with the Drinks Festival that celebrated all of it, because when you genuinely look around and see what's happening from Scotland right to the tip of Cornwall and in Northern Ireland and Wales as well, when you look and see the diversity of flavours from rum to gin, whiskey and all of the stuff we're talking about, It is a great time to be a British drinks fan right now. The other thing we've got to work on is our tourism. We want tourists to come and visit and not just go to the bars, go to the places where they're making it, make it more fun, give them a big welcome. You know, think about what you'd like when you go on holiday, when you go somewhere. You just want to have fun and engage and feel like, wow, I'm going to, every time I drink that wine, I'll think of that visit or that beer or that spirit, whatever it might be. So yeah, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent about, you know, wanting to bring the world to Britain, but yeah, I'm excited about English wine.
I totally agree, but how does that conversation, you know, go for you when you're abroad? That can happen. Is it easy to sing the praises of English wine, or is it?
Yeah, it is now the word's out, definitely. And certainly in the trade, you know, people are collecting and interested in buying English sparkling wine, and restaurants, particularly like in New York and in high-end restaurants in Denmark, I've seen it. You know, they're not just interested, they're charging top dollar for it, and in some cases more than fine champagne. And that's great to see, because they know, you know, what is on offer there, that kind of bristling bright, you know, you can't get that kind of piercing flavor from anywhere else. And it is such a good appetite sharpener. It's unbelievable. But the reds, you know, question mark, definitely. The white wines, well, do you have the breadth? Can you really make a still Chardonnay? We've seen one or two. You know, what are the grapes of the future here? I don't know the answer yet. I can certainly tell you Bacchus is a winner. You know, if I was planting anything, I would plant red Gamay and wait for the old vines in 80 years. So when my grandchildren start making wine, they would have access to some of the best fruit in Europe. And, you know, it's thinking ahead and thinking in the way actually that sort of Hookie does, you know, that wonderful brewery. They're thinking for the next generation. This isn't a conversation for now and about what we're going to deliver in the next decade. It's a conversation for the next generation and five after that. You know, what are the vineyards we think will work best? And we'll do our best guess. We'll get it wrong sometimes, of course we will, but it's a communal effort across the generations. It's a time span. I absolutely get so excited about it, and I am seeing across the world real interest in English wine stepping up. Yeah, and when we're going to meet up, by the way, we have to meet up because I'm a fan of your show, so let's meet and have some beer, and I'll bring some thrilling, nerve-tingling English fizz for you as well.
I would absolutely love that. It's an interesting point because beer is, you know, beer takes, you know, 3-4 weeks perhaps to produce most styles. So it's very tempting to think quite short term, and a lot of the campaign that we put together was you know, when we called it Keep Cask Alive, we're being over dramatic to some extent, because Cask is never going to completely disappear, but it could just become sort of a regional curiosity, just like, oh, when you're in Britain, you have to have a cask ale, or if you're in a traditional pub having a Sunday lunch, you have to have a bitter. And we're trying to avoid that. And the whole campaign was trying to say, look at the diversity that's there and look at how much we have to protect. And I think the it's so easy to be cynical about, you know, the dray horses that Hookie still use, but that's, you know, just as marketing. But that is actually thinking long term. That's actually looking at the traditions and the vital character of these beers and going, it's got to last longer than the 4 weeks between brew schedule.
Absolutely. Harvey's used them as well, and it's friendly to the environment. It's not a car. It's not pumping out diesel or petrol. It's lovely is the bottom line. It's absolutely lovely to see. I'm all in favor of all of that. I totally agree with you though on the it can't just be a gimmick. It has to be about throughput, you know, for the condition of the beer apart from anything else. I do feel so lucky, you know, living as I do near to Lewis, because I know, you know, there's some great pubs here. The throughput's phenomenal on the best, you know, the old ale at this time of the year. And that's amazing. So I really miss it when I go and you suddenly taste the pint and think, not a lot of people are drinking this in this pub. So I think it is getting people to step up. And yeah, what you're both doing, you know, I think it's also, we've got to have a conversation about diversity and bringing in people to our community of drinks. That everybody is welcome. This has to be the message. And Cask, absolutely. Just the future, I think it feels to me like it's never before been such a blank canvas, because there is this amazing product. It is delicious. It's empirically world-class. How on earth we're going to get, you know, younger people to drink it, we'll come to that. But I do think once they taste it, you know, think about what happened with coffee, and, you know, we've seen it happening. It's just a question of getting it in front of people's noses. And when they taste it, that's the moment. That's the moment where they don't look back.
So how did that happen with English wine? Was there that moment? Yeah.
No, it was a very gradual process, but it wasn't as slow as you might think. So I remember I used to go every year to what used to be called English Wine Producers. It's now called GB Wine, Great British Wine. But it's a generic body that does a tasting for all the journos and for all of the, you know, the wineries. And I remember the first few years, it was just me really in one George Street in London in this massive room and, you know, a few great producers. And, you know, it was probably 4 years and suddenly you could not get into the room. And it was a very rapid realization that quality levels were already there. It wasn't like there was a lag. People were making great stuff. And there was occasional wine writers who would still say, oh, English wine's just battery acid. But frankly, that was just lazy. They hadn't done the homework and hadn't visited and hadn't tasted. And when you do, you know, realize what you've got in the room, that's, I think, when you get enough communicators and enough other producers. I am also a great believer in a rising tide floating all boats. And it's something I said to the English wine community early on. You know, I think of a region like Marlborough in New Zealand for wine. You know, they had an identifiable grape. So Sauvignon Blanc was the thing that most of them talked about. So that was helpful. But what they did was they talked about why their region was so good for making wine. It's these wonderful blue skies. It's warm, got the maritime climate, old river estuaries, which are perfect pebble beds for growing grapes. So they would all have that message. Then they would all talk about, you know, the quality and the kind of the pristine nature of the environment. They would talk about how good generically it was, and maybe their neighbors, you should try theirs. Oh, my neighbor's doing this amazing stuff. But if you really squeeze them hard enough, they'd say, yeah, and my wine's pretty good as well. But that was last in the list. You know, the list of wonderful reasons why you should try the wine was very much like all of us are doing really exciting things. I think that, again, with Cask has to be part of the messaging. It's you know, everybody together as one. That's going to be formidable.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. So I got into beer properly probably 2009, 2010, just as beer was exploding. BrewDog had started making real impact, appearing on supermarket shelves. We then had Kernel, we had Redemption. And it was very interesting. Well, I've mentioned Redemption, who are a cask brewery predominantly, but there was a definite separation where people don't consider cask and craft as the same thing. And on the Craft Beer Channel, we see absolutely no distinction. Cask is a method of serve with a lot of benefits.
That is why I am entirely with you, standing shoulder to shoulder. I couldn't agree more. It's just it's a format. And I love all these beers that we're talking about. You know, I don't distinguish. And I guess, you know, yes, with cask, the problem is you can't maybe get it in the supermarket. But that also has to be a virtue. You know, you need to go to the pub. And this brings us to the pub, actually. And I know, you know, you two are absolutely, you know, as I am, but I think the institution of the pub and what that has guarded for our society all these centuries is one of the greatest legacies in our heritage. I really do. The top to bottom of society in one place, with the freedom to talk and to voice an opinion over a fantastic beer. That's something that's vital in my life. I adore it. I think it's almost like we have to think of that as the thing that is the joy of it. You have to go to the pub. I want to take you two to the pub.
On that note, Ollie, can you tell me about your absolute favourite pub? Is it a local? Is it somewhere further afield? Maybe you visit from time to time. I want to know what's your optimal drinking experience in there?
This is such a good question. I really love the Jolly Sportsman in East Chiltington. It's local to me. I know the guys. I film there a lot anyway, but they deliver great beer in great condition. They deliver fabulous food and a good wine list, and it's a warm welcome, and you've got a sitting area. You've got a really informal area around the bar for locals. You've got a great garden for families, lovely views of the downs. It kind of ticks all the boxes for a country pub, and they're a brilliant team. So I'd give them a shout. If I'm in Lewis, I drink in a lot of pubs in Lewis, and I'm always happy to go to the Brewers, the Swan. I'll be down at the John Harvey, sometimes the Lansdowne. If I'm in Lewis, the Lewis Arms, I will basically be in the pub. I absolutely love it.
That's just one minute you're talking about, right?
More or less. Yeah. Well, yeah, just following the trail of condition. But I guess, I'd give a shout. I mean, my local village pub is wonderful, and the quality of the beer there is good. But the thing is, there are so many that this is the tricky thing. But I think in my ideal pub, Brad, I just want basically people relaxed. I equate the sound of a really good game of cricket, if you've ever heard that sound of just a happy murmuring about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's a similar vibe to a really good pub. It's just a gentle bubbling of like everything's going really well. It's just really nice to see everyone. And that's really what the heart of the pub is for me. I actually really do want to go to the Fountain. To my shame, I've not been on the Silicon Roundabout. And I watching your films, I was just so reminded of how I love discovering new pubs. Oh, the other pub I love. It's the Square and Compass in Worth Matravers, but that's more of a cider. I mean, they do beer, but I go there for the cider. Just the views. It's like an old stone carving community there, and the views out over the channel. And I love walking in nature and out in the hills in the summer. So that's always a destination pub. Charlie's Cider, though. Wow, Eve's idea. Don't have too many pints of that. You'll end up singing George Harrison.
That's another thing we've mentioned Gabe already, but it feels like cider's having a little bit of a moment, and it had a very good budget last week. And I think, there's going to be a time where perhaps we're going to be talking about, they do almost have appellations at this point in cider. Certainly cider writers would tell you about that. It's a very interesting moment for cider, I think, because they have a bit of a blank slate perhaps compared to English wine and British beer.
I was amazed. I did a little tour with Gabe, and we went to Gloucestershire, Herefordshire and Devon. Saw some incredible bottle conditioned ciders, rivaling, in my view, some of the greatest sparkling wines in the world. Tom Oliver, Little Pomona, Founder Foster, they were great. I mean, there's just so many brilliant producers. And then you've got, big numbers like Weston, who are actually doing a pretty good job, with the juice. And who else did we see? We saw, Sanford Orchards down in Devon near my parents. Oh, yeah. So I tasted there. Their cider is really like Barney, actually, who runs it. And it's literally 2 miles from my folks. And then next week on Saturday Kitchen, there's like a pulled pork burger. I thought, bingo, Sanford Orchards. And everyone loved it. We did Devon Red, and it's just too delicious not to like it. And I think you're right. Cider will have, no doubt, a great future now. And I can't believe there's so much fruit that doesn't get used from the harvest, because, that to me, I just think of all that potential. I can't imagine that in a vineyard. It doesn't really work for me. I just wish there was, same as the car. There's just more reverence for the heritage and tradition. But I do think people like Gabe are going to bring cider to a massive audience. Watch this space.
Mm. We touched on it a little while ago, but you mentioned, we talked about appellations and designations of origin and stuff like that. So at the end of our series, Keep Cask Alive, we said that we were hoping to take the video evidence that we've shot, the series, and then also lots more evidence to UNESCO.
Yes.
To try and get cask as a format listed as intangible heritage, like Belgian beer culture?
Yes, it should be. How do I help? What do we do? Yes, sign me up. Yes, 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 absolutely.
Well, your first name on the petition. There we go. Great.
Yeah.
But I just wondered, has there been any precedence of that in wine where you know, there's been real vineyards protected or stuff like that?
Santorini is a UNESCO heritage site, and quite right, it is too. It's a historic monument. You know, these vines, they don't know how old they are, is the truth of it. But the roots in the volcanic soil, they could be hundreds of years old. They could be older. There are some growers who'll have you believe they stretch back to, you know, Homeric and classical Greek times, which maybe, who knows? I mean, you know, vines, you know, they lop the tops off down to the soil and then they just regenerate. So the root system in the soil, I honestly can't tell you. I don't know, but it's deservedly, you know, that's part of. And the reason they did that was, you know, the pressure on real estate and on holidays and all of that stuff was threatening those vines, and they are unique to Greece and Santorini heritage. So there's absolutely, I think the Douro is as well, the Douro Valley with port. So, you know, textural things, you know, totally should be part of that. I think that's a really brilliant ambition and fully support that, because yes, it is part of the heritage of these islands, no question. And it is, you know, it is under threat. You know, that's why you're doing your campaign, and brilliant it is too. And by the way, Bradley, your camera work is astonishing. I genuinely watched it thinking, who's on camera? I realize it's Brad. I'm like, okay, that's, yeah, you're really good.
Thanks, man. That's all. I did used to work in TV, so I got a bit of experience. But if you ever need a cameraman to come and film some YouTube-style content, I'm here, dude.
Particularly slow-mo of people drinking.
Oh, slow-mo. Loved it. Slow-mo.
Oh, yeah. And your opening credits, was that you? When the beer gets put down and then the ghostly credits come up. Oh, that pint. Yeah. Who drank that pint? Because I want that pint. I've dreamt about that pint.
Well, it sounds like we're all going to go and drink that pint.
Yeah, we should. Immediately. Soon, right? Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It was a wonderful moment in the shoot, because I can't remember where I'd gone. I think I'd taken a phone call or something, and Brad had just got out some like little fairy lights and was like, I'm just going to do the intro shot. And I was like, okay, Brad. And it was, yeah, fairy lights for bokeh and yeah, some serious slow-mo. And it was, I mean, it's my favorite part of every episode. That's why I put it at the start of all five of them. Yeah.
Talking of mutual admiration, you've got a great podcast called A Glass With. Shout out A Glass With.
Thank you so much. That's very nice of you. Yes.
Go check it out, everyone. We all know, like, wine, beer is a great social lubricant. If you could have a pint of beer with anyone, living or deceased, who would it be and what would you talk about?
Brad, why have you gone full blind date? What?
This is a great question. I was very lucky. I did meet my hero growing up was Roger Moore, and I did get to meet him and become friendly with him. So he would be, if I could bring him back for the day, he's unimpeachably the nicest and kindest person I ever met, and was also brilliant company over a drink. And I really miss him, and he would be great. But I suspect Rog would prefer a glass of Sancerre to a pint. So that said, I'm going to, can I have Elizabeth the First? I've always been quite curious about Elizabeth the First. I think she's an incredible leader and a real pragmatist. And I studied her at school, and I've just always felt like there's this, she has a, you know, everyone thinks of Henry VIII when they think of old British monarchs. I kind of think Elizabeth actually was the godmother of everything we are today. And so I would like to have a pint of, whatever she wants, really, but as long as it's cask, I'm happy. A pint with Elizabeth I, please. And wow. I would talk about the Armada and give us some pointers on, I want her tailor's address. You know, if I could get some shirts done like her dresses, I'd love to know. Yeah, big ruffles. I wonder about, you know, big, huge outfits, huge numbers. So when I'm on those stilts at the festival, you know, I want to be basically dressed up by Elizabeth I Taylor with a pint of cask balanced on my head and a dimple jug. How about that?
It also might work as padding when you inevitably go down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so Elizabeth I, it shall be. I think she'd be amazing.
I'm sure she would have drunk beer. They all drank beer as safer than water.
Yeah.
And
probably small beer. Yeah. What do you reckon, Brad?
I think so. Did she like drugs as well, right? Or was that more the Victorian era they got into?
I think that might have been, I did hear about Queen Victoria. I think the Victorians were more that, but who knows? I mean, you know, I'll ask Elizabeth the first when I have my
when you bring her back, just ask her what she likes.
Didn't she used to put lead on her face, I think?
Yeah. There was a lot of lead poisoning. Absolutely there was. Yeah. And the white powder. And I think they were probably, really smelly, because if they were, I mean, they had like a bath a year. So
yeah,
I might have to have a pint at a distance with loud hailers. It's getting quite an eccentric bar setting, this, with Elizabeth.
I think you should have it outside, probably somewhere outside, windy. Great. And upwind. Perfect. Sorry.
Upwind. Yep. Yeah, great. Yes, good. Yes. No, we'll do that. Yeah.
Is Roger Moore your favourite Bond then, before we move back to sensible talk?
Yeah, because I grew up with Roger as Bond, and then, you know, hung out with him, and yeah, totally is. Although, you know, I think Daniel Craig's done a pretty good innings. Brosnan's hilarious. Every now and again, if I want cheering up, I'll just watch GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies back to back. I mean, it just can't fail to make you smile. His hair alone is just entertaining. And then Lazenby's quite interesting. I always feel for Lazenby and Dalton. You know, that always makes quite a good triple bill, you know, those guys. But then obviously, you know, Connery. I mean, Connery. Yeah, oh. you can't beat Connery.
I think Dalton deserved longer.
I do.
And I also think that now probably he's better known for being in Hot Fuzz, because that's on every weekend, basically, at this point. But I enjoyed him as a Bond.
Yeah, Living Daylights is great. And License to Kill has its moments. It just feels a little bit glossy and a bit more Americanized. But like Living Daylights was you could have stuck any of them in that and it would have been a recognizable Bond.
You're a real crazy Bond fan. This is...
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely, yeah. Well, going back to being a kid, I was. These days, you know, kind of... I did actually go to the premiere of the last one, No Time to Die, which was unexpected. But thank you very much, Champagne Bollinger, for that. That was quite a night. Saw Danny in his big pink tuxedo and thought, I want to nick that. Yes!
we should all do a podcast, I reckon, called Male Bonding. Which is all about talking about Bond and how it's shaped us as men.
What are your favourite Bond movies? I'm controversially For Your Eyes Only, although close second would be Spy Who Loved Me. I do love Spy Who Loved Me, but For Your Eyes Only, first Bond at the cinema.
For Your Eyes Only. I always liked The Man with the Golden Gun. I really loved that. Scaramanga, Man with the Third Nipple. Nick-Nack, the little guy. Yeah. He puts him in a suitcase at the end. I always found that hilarious. Mm.
And Britt Eklund as well, I actually interviewed on a glass with quite recently.
Wow.
We shared a glass of fizz. I think, what did I send her? Oh, yeah, I sent her some Bollinger. I mean, you would, wouldn't you? Even though Dom Perignon did feature in the film. There's a story there, but I'm not going to tell you now. I'll tell you at the pub. I'll tell you at the pub. How about you? What's your favourite?
I've got to be honest, it's probably Casino Royale.
That's a good
one. Well, the Daniel Craig one.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to argue with that. That's amazing. It's my daughter Lily's favourite Bond as well. I think it's a great film.
Just fine taste.
Yeah.
Yeah. It got me back into Bond, and then I went back and watched all the old ones again because I'd forgotten how good Bond could be at its best.
Yeah.
I love Mads Mikkelsen. He's the bad guy in Casino Royale.
Literally crying blood. Yeah.
Le Chiffre.
Literally crying blood. He's a wonderful actor. Have you guys seen his film called Another Round, which is about drinking?
No.
Oh, wow. Maybe I won't go into that one, but it's basically there's a Danish philosopher that says we're all born with a 0.5% alcohol deficiency, so we should all drink to be 0.5% alcohol in our blood system to perform optimally. So him and a group of his friends all sort of start this mission to basically drink on the job, literally and metaphorically, for a period of time. It's very interesting.
I'm not sure he's a philosopher.
Who, Mads? Yeah. Well, he was the face of Carlsberg for a while, wasn't he?
He was.
I remember...
Keep Carlsberg alive, is it?
I visited their brewery there when I was in Copenhagen, and I didn't realise they were so philanthropic. The original family. And, you know, they purified yeast and, you know, sent, you know the story. But it was... Yeah. It's quite instructive. I saw that. I went into that lab where they did that and then shared it with the world royalty free. And I thought, well, that's quite a noble contribution to culture. Mads Free, is he still the face of Carlsberg?
I think he might be. I haven't seen an advert of that recently, but it can't be more than a year since I saw the one. There's a boat and he pushes someone in the water or something.
He's like riding a bicycle around all over the place and stuff, isn't he?
Yeah. We're
having a fever dream here of what his potential.
We're having a three-way fever dream about Mads, and who ever thought that was going to happen? And we haven't even had a pint. I've got
one. Brad has.
I've just got my oolong tea. What is this? Phoenix honey orchid, I think. I'm into tea as well. It's ludicrous. There's just no end to my fascination for liquids.
It's a slippery slope. definitely.
It is, yeah. Once you get in there, yeah.
Right. Well, keep Karsk alive. Keep Bond alive. Keep Mads alive. yes. These are all campaigns we can dig into eventually.
What is next for Keep Karsk Alive, actually? What's ideally, like, and budget no question, yeah, what would be your dream scenario to get going with it?
Well, that would be the UNESCO campaign. So
cool.
What I'd love to do is to make a documentary of us trying to get it listed, because there's going to be
a good shout.
Lots of travel involved, lots more evidence to gather, like I said, like the hop and the malt harvest, perhaps a couple more brewers. The one thing we didn't do, which is shocking, is anything outside of England. So I'd love to go to Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. In fact, we had, off the back of the campaign, quite a few people from Northern Ireland say, if you think it's dire in England, in Northern Ireland, it really needs to be saved. So doing a second series that also folds in this UNESCO campaign.
Great.
I understand the process involves going to an annual UNESCO meetup where you get to pitch, which I think could be quite an exciting episode.
We need to get Liz Truss or whoever. Who is the foreign secretary now? I can't remember. Is it Liz? Someone. I once went on a mission to China with Liz Truss years ago as part of the Great Britain or Britain is Great campaign. One of those two. But it was basically to promote British drinks. That was my role there. But if you get the right person involved, you know, at government level, that would definitely help. And I can't see why they wouldn't jump on it. It's a brilliant campaign.
Well, they've already, with the budget, they've made that step to reduce duty on draft beer, which at the moment is at 40 litres, which should include most casks. So right. I think there is an awareness in the government that supporting pubs and supporting cask ale is very important. Yep. But I think we all underestimate, you know, when I asked you earlier, it's a bit facetious, sort of going, why do you think cask is in decline? There's a million little knives being stuck in it every day by, you know, by duty, by pubcos and the tie and all these things that are really causing small cask brewers to struggle and medium-sized cask brewers to struggle. And so probably if we can get the UNESCO listing, our next job will be to go around and break the beer tie, which people haven't been trying to do for about 300 years. So why shouldn't we manage it?
Yeah. What would it take?
I'm thinking like a true crime podcast about the corruption at the top. That's where I want to take it.
Nailing the baddies, definitely in with that.
Could be the next Bond film. I could be the next Bond. Or Brad. Yeah. Sorry.
I think you could both do it. Yeah, share the role.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I could be two Bonds. Like, I could be quirky Q. I could be Q. Well, it's a new approach, isn't it?
I think we could try and make ourselves look as similar to each other as possible. And then we could take I could sort of cut my hair a bit. Johnny, you could put on a bit of weight. What do you reckon?
So we can be in three places at the same time? Is that your thinking?
No. So we're all Bond together, but we're all playing the same person.
That's very funny, because of course so many people have played Bond in different films. If you had that in one film, surprised Austin Powers didn't do that. That would have been really funny. But Austin
just
Powers
a different just actor,
inexplicably walked in played by a different actor every 10 minutes. Yeah, but nobody refers to it. Why would they? I mean, you know.
I'm trying to think of how to end this podcast, and I don't know how
Just high five each other.
Just high five.
Are we ending already? I've got lots of silly questions I can ask.
Far away, Brad. I'm up for silly questions.
Okay. All right. This one's not that silly, but we all know you're amazing at wine and food matching, but what's your best cask ale and food pairing? We could be talking the humble but delicious traditional pub snack or full-on gastropub fare. The sky is the absolute limit, Ollie. What are you saying?
Well, this is a very good area, because I have enjoyed, you know, things like old ale with a cheeky brownie in the past. But lovely. I think, it's a nice little, it's an afternoon tea time snack. But my wife's favourite thing in the world, she does like a bit of a pub salad and a pint of best. But I kind of think the cheese straw with a pint of best is very hard to beat. And I think when I apply the rule of when the drink is sensational. So let's imagine you had the best bottle of wine ever. The temptation is to think, well, I must have a really fancy meal. But I always advise people actually just get a slab of mature cheddar or one simple thing, you know, that goes with it, and just really let the drink shine. And that would be my approach with cask, actually. I'd keep it really, really simple. Salty flavors do work. Then bright flavors. I've had wonderful bright flavors with shellfish. Oh, you've really put me on the spot, Brad. I want it all. I mean, I've had... Oh, Brad, we need to go drinking and put it to the test. But I think yes. A cheese straw and a pint of best is, you know, you've got me. If you, I will say yes to anything if you waggle those under my face.
I think cheese and beer is the ultimate pairing. It is. What's the term? An iconic duo.
Yeah.
It's barley wine and Stickleton cheese is my...
Yes.
That's my thing.
Oh, yes.
Or West Coast IPA and like Monty's cheddar or something like that. It's just incredible.
Yeah. And I think with those big sort of IPAs as well, the temptation to sort of go for spicy food, I actually find it a bit much. I find the hops and the spice bit much, really. I think keep it simple. Oh, my word. We have to go eating and drinking now. This is great.
Ollie, this one, you can do this one when we leave you. All Val and pickled onion monster munch. Give that a go, sir. You're in for a treat.
I love both of those, and I've never put them together. And pickled onion flavored monster munches are genuinely one of my favorite flavors on the planet. So, Brad, I'm so chuffed that you've found a pairing because I genuinely didn't think there was one. Hey. Amazing.
Yeah. It was Johnny that discovered it, but hey.
All right, Johnny, hats off to you. I'm going to order my Orval beer merchants will have some, won't they? Or someone will have some online. Yeah. I'll go and do that now. Yeah, amazing.
There we go. Well, I think we found it. I think we found the way out of this podcast, out of this bizarre maze.
Well, you say that, but I'm still trapped in here. I'm here for eternity.
Pickled onion and...
Yeah, literally, I'm living in here. It's great. It's roomy. I like what you've done with the place.
there's always plenty of brain space for Brad. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you so much for loving what we've done and throwing some support behind the campaign by being part of this, because... I think it's hopefully going to be the most important thing we've ever done. You know, it's, you struggle for meaning, I think, sometimes as a beer writer or maybe a wine writer, trying to, you know, people say, you know, what impact are you having on the world other than spreading enormous joy? And I think that this is a way that we can ensure that that joy is directed in a way that can last for a lot longer than say the Craft Beer Channel does.
Fantastic words. And back into the people who, you know, do the work and deliver the goods. You know, that's where the respect lies. It's just brilliant. Yes. Oh, I'm excited. Can we go for a pint?
Let's talk about beer, Johnny. Let's talk about AVB. Let's talk about Imperial Stouts and Imbibe Buyouts of Wicked Weed. Let's talk about beer. Let's talk about beer. Let's talk about beer. Let's talk about beer.
So I wrote all my questions in advance and I did my best to keep the train on the tracks, but we still eventually came off with a lot of talk about Bond.
Johnny, we've out of this experience, we've now got a new podcast format, Male Bonding.
We do.
Which is well worth the hour we've just spent talking.
That, and we have saved Cask Ale.
Oh, single-handedly, obviously. Or triple-handedly, should I say.
Yeah.
Hand in hand. Skipping along, me, you, and Ollie, skipping along, hand in hand, looking into the bright future of Cask Ale.
Yeah, it was really interesting when he said that he thinks that Cask Ale has its brightest days are ahead of it. And I really hope that that's the case. And I really, he kind of convinced me when he said it. There's so many barriers to that actually happening that we have to break through. And I hope that our campaign can really help that. And also, you know, like I referenced, the budget has taken a small step towards that. So he's right. Things are going in the right direction. And I think now is the time to really strike. We've timed this extremely well, I think, the campaign with the budget announcement, with the interest in drinking local, eating seasonally, drinking seasonally, and the little kind of, little bump in interest in sort of bitters, porters being made by, you know, outwardly very modern breweries such as his local Beak, have just released a porter, and I think they've just released a bitter maybe as well. So I think we're on the zeitgeist here, and we can hopefully use that to really ensure the future of Cask. And I really appreciate Ollie coming on and giving us some guidance, giving us some insight into how he sees it from just outside the beer bubble, and hopefully we're going to learn a lot from that and really make a difference next year.
Beautiful.
So thank you very much for listening. Thanks for Ollie for coming on the podcast. I can't wait to go for a beer with him at the Fountain. And you can sign up in the podcast description. You can sign up to our newsletter where we'll be updating on the campaign once it gets going, which will be in probably the first quarter of next year. So sign up for that. You get all the details that you need to know. And if you can help us, please email craftbeerboys@gmail.com. We're open to ideas, support, funding, whatever it is you think you can throw our way. If you're passionate about Cask, we would absolutely love to hear from you. So get in touch. All the links you need are in the podcast description. The next podcast going live with The Bubble is with the amazing Gabe Cook, who we mentioned in the podcast. So watch out for that in a couple of weeks, in which we'll be talking about the future of British cider. Love and beer. The Bubble and Friday 5pm podcast are brought to you by the nerds behind YouTube's Craft Beer channel. You can watch over 400 mini documentaries at youtube.com/thecraftbeerchannel. And if you love what we do, support us via Patreon and get access to merchandise and our amazing Discord forum, a positive and welcoming space for everyone who loves beer, food and homebrewing. Love and beer.